Hey everyone, I'm Phil.
And I'm Molly.
And I've got bad news and good news. Do what you want first. The bad news or the
bad
good news?
Bad news, always.
The bad news is we're not to monster movies yet.
Yep, I know.
The good news is we're done with Black and White Orphans.
Good.
The bad news is we are doing a comedy, which you hate. The good news is it's Preston Sturges, who you kind of like.
Who? When did you get the impression that I liked him?
Because you kind of liked Sullivan's Travels.
I mean, I like Preston Sturges.
Preston whom? Surgeons.
I said Sturges.
Preston Sturges. Well, I figure if you like one of his movies, it's considered one of his greatest movies. Maybe you'll like another one of his movies that's considered one of his greatest movies.
Yeah, I liked almost all of Del Toro's movies. Then we got to Crimson Peak.
That's true. Well, this is 1948's Unfaithfully Yours, about which I will say very little because it's a Preston Sturges movie and I don't want to give anything away. Plus, I've never seen it. All I will tell you is that it has Rex Harrison in it.
Don't know who that is.
He played a Dr. Doolittle in the Dr. Doolittle movie.
Never seen it.
He played Henry Higgins in the My Fair Lady movie.
Never seen it.
He couldn't sing, yet he got cast in a lot of singing leads because he could talk the words. Why can't the... He was British. Also, people hated working with him. It has Rudy Valley.
Don't know who that is.
Rudy Valley was famous for singing through a megaphone.
So he sang through a megaphone like this.
How's that annoying?
How's that make you feel?
Annoyed.
Annoyed. He also tried to get a certain street named after him, but he failed. And so it is still called Sunset Boulevard. Also, he was left-handed. I know everything I know about Rudy Valley. I know from this book I used to own when I was a kid called, like, World Famous Left-Handers. That's how I know that Rudy Valley was left-handed.
Why did you have that book?
Because I'm left-handed, and I bought a book about it. It also...
You needed that self-esteem boost?
It also has Barbara Lawrence and Linda Darnell, Kurt Kruger, Lionel Stander, Edgar Kennedy, and Alan Bridge. I don't know who any of these people are. It's directed by Preston Sturges, written by Preston Sturges, produced by Preston Sturges, and directed by Preston Sturges. Wait, did I already say that?
Yes.
And that's all I know about it. Also, Guillermo del Toro really likes it, but we'll talk about that one a little bit later.
He really likes a lot of movies.
He likes a lot of movies. That's why he has so many movies to look at.
Like The Raven.
He likes The Raven. We like The Raven! And we know why he likes The Raven. Once again, ladies and gentlemen... We liked The Raven. All right. So are you excited?
No.
About? Are you geared up?
No.
Are you ready to watch? Are you going to watch
yes.
Unfaithfully Yours? Good. Here we go, everyone. Oh, by the way, it's Del Toro time. It's Del Toro time.
It's Del Toro time.
I mean, you can pick up with Evil Dead 2. It's not going to like, you're not going to miss anything.
Does it have better actors in it?
Mm-hmm. And slightly higher budget. And it actually, the first 20 minutes of Evil Dead 2 covers all the plot of Evil Dead 1, just in a very pared down. He lost the rights to Evil Dead 1, like actually lost the rights to the footage of it because they changed production companies, they changed distributors. So he couldn't use any of footage from Evil Dead 1 for flashbacks in Evil Dead 2. So they had to basically refilm the entire movie in a very ultra-condensed form to show at the beginning of Evil Dead 2. They cut out most of the characters. He just turns it about, me and my girlfriend went to a cabin in the woods. But it tells you the story of Evil Dead 1, so you're really caught up by the time you get to the end. So you can just watch Evil Dead 2 and enjoy all the insanity.
There's no trees in it, are there?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I had to turn it off after that. I couldn't.
Yeah, it's a rough scene. A classically rough scene.
It was unexpected.
It was very unexpected.
What is the remake any good?
The remake's awesome. It's far more brutal than the original because it doesn't shy away from anything. but it's almost all practical effects too. It's still like almost all like latex and goop and
I like practical effects.
But it's vicious. And it takes place within the Evil Dead universe. It's not a remake per se. It's a retelling of the same basic story, but I believe when they get to the cabin in the beginning, the car from Evil Dead is still there. Like, it's supposed to be the same cabin, basically. And just to sort of like, here we go again.
Oh my!
If you have a weak stomach, it's not.
I don't like to gore or anything. Not really.
It does have a tree sequence though.
I'll just skip that.
It does have a remake of the tree sequence. Just fair warning.
Yeah, I.
It makes. If I remember correctly, they make it make more sense, plot wise, in the sequel, like why it's occurring. The undead, the evil force is a lot more vicious in the remake. But also like there's a little more plot involved in what they're going.
It's
through.
Not just a bunch of.
They take. If I remember, they take. A friend of theirs, one of the girls in the group, they're taking her up to the cabin to detox her because she's been addicted to like heroin or something. And so the friends like get her and they take her out to a cabin to spend a long like vacation there, away from like the city, away from her source, and kind of like detoxify her. So
that would be
so
awful.
in addition to awakening the evil dead, she's also experiencing like severe withdrawal. And so there's this whole thing where like they don't know at times if she's just going through withdrawal or if there's something actually happening, which sort of adds this extra layer. And it sounds hokey, but it is, but it also works. The actors are all, they're all dynamite. This has been our Evil Dead cast. hey everyone, I'm Phil.
And I'm Ollie.
And
it's Del Toro time.
It's Del Toro time and we are back with the Ecstasy of
Influence. Thank you for redoing that intro with me. Because you ruined it last time we recorded it.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I totally did that. Hey, we're back. We just watched Unfaithfully Yours.
We just watched it a week ago.
A 1948's Unfaithfully Yours. We are still kind of... I am personally still kind of reeling from this film. It's... I don't get it.
Yeah, no. Uh-huh. I think it's entertaining and I think it's good.
Yeah. But... What is it about? It is. Okay, well, in a nutshell, what is it about?
A conductor?
Yes, who, a world-famous British conductor.
Who...
It got very quiet outside. Yeah. The air conditioning next door shut off, and the rain stopped, and the window is open, and there's thunder.
It's about a conductor who's married to this really pretty woman.
Who's much younger than him.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. who adores him and he adores her.
Yeah.
And then there's these two characters. There's his brother-in-law and her sister, yeah, were also married, obviously.
Yes.
That's basically it. That's what it's about.
That's your setup.
Yeah. There you go.
He's been out of town and he's come back.
Mm-hmm.
And while he was out, the brother-in-law, who is a nerd, or how would you describe him?
Percy Weasley.
Yeah, he is zero fun. He is a dry, no fun man. And his wife is very fun.
Mm-hmm. I like his wife.
Yeah, she is a delight. Before he went away, he told the brother-in-law to
keep an eye on his wife.
Meaning,
please make sure she doesn't get hurt, and also if she gets lonely, invite her over for dinner or something.
Right, but the brother-in-law took it to mean...
Hire a detective to stalk my wife, thank you.
Yes, so and the brother-in-law, who is, again, a nerd and very dry...
I don't want to call him a nerd, because I feel offended by that.
He's an old-school nerd. He's played by Rudy Valley, which is amazing, because Rudy Valley was a teenage heartthrob before this period. But this guy, he's like bespectacled and very just like, oh, well, you told me to keep an eye on your wife, so I hired a detective. Okay. But what has the detective discovered?
Nothing.
Nothing. But what does the detective think he's discovered?
A cheating wife.
Yeah. So the wife is...
No, he doesn't even come out and say that, like, oh, I think I've discovered your wife has been cheating on you. He's just like, so your wife went into a room and it didn't come out for a while.
Your wife went into the room of your, like, secretary and wearing only lingerie. And that's it. She didn't come out for 18 minutes. And that's all And he has written up a report, but... The conductor, Sir Alfred de Carter, played by Rex Harrison, tears up the report. Won't read it.
All the reports.
Yes.
Every copy.
Every time he comes across a copy of it, he tears it up. Won't read it.
What about the trash can scene? When he throws and he tears up the thing, sets it on fire, and kicks the trash can out of the room.
And then he sets everything on fire.
Yes. And then the brother comes back and he has the pieces of the report all taped together.
Oh, it wasn't the brother. It was the hotel detective.
Right.
Who did that? Yeah, there's a hotel detective as well.
And he was like, I found this in your trash can that you kicked out of the room and set on fire.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, if I tear something up, put it in a trash can and burn it, do you really think I want it back?
Well, I guess he did, because he put it back together. So the thing is, Sir Alfred has a huge concert that night that everyone's looking forward to.
It takes place during one day.
Yeah, this is a really like compact movie. It's also only like an hour and a little over an hour and a half long.
It's good.
So he has this big concert going on. The whole city's coming to see it, and he's going to be playing three pieces in the concert. And what happens during the concert?
He freaks out.
And?
Imagines killing his wife.
Okay, so he's playing three pieces.
He doesn't imagine killing his wife for all of them.
Right. The first time he imagines.
He does this convoluted,
messy
plan to kill his wife.
That works perfectly.
In his imagination.
And then the second time.
We couldn't figure out if he was imagining it at first.
Right. But it does this thing where it pushes in on his eye, and then the concert's kind of over. And it quickly becomes clear that everyone's kind of behaving a little out of character.
Yeah.
So he fantasizes murdering his wife in this very convoluted scheme.
And also getting his secretary arrested.
Right, right. Framing his secretary for the murder. The second thing he fantasizes is.
Forgiving her.
Yes,
yeah.
Is forgiving her and writing her a huge check.
And letting her and the secretary go live together forever.
Yes, and then the third time.
He fantasizes about killing himself.
Right, with a game of Russian roulette. And then the concert ends. And he storms off to the house to enact his.
The entire time this is going on, though, his wife is just getting more and more concerned and confused.
Right, because he's acting like a total jerk to her.
Yeah, and he's never done this before,
because
they're, like, deeply in love.
Totally out of character for him. He rushes home to enact his plan of murdering his wife. He tries to enact his fantasy, but it ends up becoming...
Hilarious.
A legitimately hilarious slapstick
sequence. It ends
up
becoming a Charlie Chaplin movie.
Yeah, he's trying to... He thinks he's so smooth, he thinks he's so suave, that you can almost forget that you're watching a man literally trying to murder his wife. For something that isn't even correct. Because then she comes home and he finds out the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a weird truth?
Yeah.
Like, what happened?
She was like, I don't even know. Oh, her brother-in-law was like, hey, have you seen my wife anywhere?
Yeah.
And she was like, oh no, I think I know what's happening. So she went to the secretary's place, but she wasn't like wearing, like, she's only wearing like night clothes.
Right.
So she was like, oh, this is going to look scandalous if anyone sees this, whatever. Because she thought that her sister was cheating on her husband with the secretary.
Right.
So she went into the room and she saw nothing. So she waited in the room for 18 minutes.
Because the hotel detective was out, the detective was waiting outside in the hall and
yeah.
She saw him.
And she was like, oh, this would look bad if I. And then she left and went back home.
And he's like, I love you. Like, he's like, oh, I love you. And she's like, I forgive you for being a jerk. And that's it.
Yep.
That's it.
That's the entire movie.
And as an audience, you're like, well, he was planning on murdering her just 5 minutes ago. But I guess it takes place in that weird, like, comedy universe thing where you're like, it's not supposed to be. This isn't supposed to be a realistic movie. Obviously, the director and writer, Preston Sturges, had an idea, a concept that he wanted to carry through. And where do you think the concept hung? Like, what do you think the concept was?
I don't know.
It was weird. It was weird because at the end of the movie, I was like, well, that was very entertaining. And the characters were all, like, delightful and everyone did a great job. But what was he trying to say?
I think my favorite character is still the cymbals guy.
Oh yeah, you get to see him like rehearsing with the it's a real orchestra that they got. Like, it wasn't actors playing an orchestra. But what happened with the cymbals guy?
He wanted the main guy was like, you need to be louder, and he was like, okay, and then he scurried around the back and got these giant cymbals and just.
What I loved about that whole sequence, you get to see him working with the orchestra, and Rex Harrison studied like a lot to be like to do like his like to look like a real conductor. But what I loved about that sequence was you got to see that he was a good conductor. Like, everyone liked him. Like, he was a likable, like, they really set up well throughout the movie that he is a legitimately likable guy, because you're going to watch him be a despicable guy later on. And I think they were kind of stacking the deck, like, just to show you, no. He's really a nice guy. He's just trying to murder his wife for no reason.
Because
it's hard. I mean, I don't know. I think Sturgis does a pretty good job at not making you just absolutely hate this man.
I feel like going through like the motions with him during the concert really mm-hmm. builds up like the empathy
yeah.
that you feel towards him, or the sympathy.
Yeah.
And then it's just hilarious.
So this movie came out in 1948, but it was written in 1932.
Whoa.
It says
the world wasn't ready for it.
Yes, it's a little ahead of its time. The production note said that Preston Sturges was listening to a sad song while he was writing a comedy scene, and he was like, "Huh, that's an interesting idea." What was pointed out is that each piece in the movie that he has he imagines each plot in his head to a different piece of music. The first one is to the overture of Rossini's Semiramide. I don't
know how to pronounce Good it. Job.
The one where he forgives her and writes her a check is written to a Wagner piece, and the Russian roulette scene is to Tchaikovsky's Francesca da Rimini. Each one of these pieces of music is actually very, very thematically... The music he's listening to is kind of informing his fantasy life. He didn't want Rex Harrison as the lead originally. There was a lot of other like
wasn't
actors.
He like was it Rex Harrison like a jerk?
Rex Harrison is a jerk. Or oh was right, a jerk. He died a jerk. Okay. He lived a jerk. He died a jerk. He was younger in this movie than I'm used to seeing him. I'm used to My Fair Lady Rex Harrison. He's still supposed to be like an older guy, but you see him shirtless and he doesn't look half bad. I say. It's like he's in good shape. He's a good shape dude. apparently there was some controversy because his character, Sir Alfred de Carter, was people accused Sturges of basing him on a real conductor named Thomas Beecham. And even the studio was like, you can't do this. Is too like Beecham was like a British conductor who was very popular and had like a younger wife and was known for being a little bit fiery and emotional. And the part of the controversy came from the fact that, okay, this is on Wikipedia and I looked it up and it is true. Beecham's grandfather was a guy named Thomas Beecham, who was a chemist who invented pills called Beecham's pills, which were laxatives. And they were sold as Carter's little liver pills. And so that's why he named the character Carter, as a callback to liver pills, which is a callback to Thomas Beecham, which is a callback to Sir Thomas Beecham, the conductor. It's like this extended, like, I don't know what you would even call that. But
A reach is what you would call that.
But nobody knew how to sell this movie. It was, like, how do you sell a comedy about a guy trying to murder his wife?
Oh.
Yeah, this is before Alfred Hitchcock made, like, the sort of dark comedy popular, like with a little humor in your murder story. So apparently the original tagline was, "Will somebody get her tonight?" Which doesn't even make any sense. Get it? Get like murder her or date her. Date with her. I would date with you. Anyway, tell us about the voice recorder.
Oh my god.
So talk about this device.
In the fantasy he has of the murdering his wife, there's this voice recorder that he gets down and he uses it to record himself.
Oh no, wait. Describe the voice recorder though. Like what is it like?
It's a mess. What is it?
It like weighs 100 pounds.
You put a record yeah. on there. I almost called it a cassette tape, nope. but I knew that was wrong.
Yep.
put a record on there. You put the pin down.
Yeah.
And then you record on it.
But there's and you connect all these like, mm-hmm. like you have to stick all these wires into certain like.
And the instructions are just
gobbledy garbage. But yeah. So in his fantasy,
it works perfectly, and he manages to mimic her voice perfectly using frequency changers.
Yeah, what does he yell into it? He's all,
"Help, police, murder." What is the secretary's name?
Tony.
Tony, stop. What are you doing? Tony, blah, 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 blah.
And then he plays it back at just like high speed.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a woman screaming. And we were like,
That was when I was like, yeah, he's definitely
dreaming yeah. because the when he's actually trying to do his murder plot. just getting the recording device down is like 15 minutes of film, and it is
hilarious.
It is nightmarishly hilarious. Just this sort of, and you realize that he is not as strapping and competent as he thinks he is.
At least not in this.
Right. But he yells, he figures out how to get it to record. This is after he literally destroys his living room. Like, he smashes through several chairs. He drops a whole...
This is when Mitzi started watching with us.
That's right. It becomes just a full-on, like, Three Stooges-esque slapstick. But he gets the recorder working, and then he records, like, help, police, murder. And then he plays it back, and it's all like... And if you want me to laugh, that's all you have to do. Like, I was like, this is the best movie I've ever seen in my life.
It was great.
Those machines were real. Those were legitimately, like, maybe not operated exactly like they should, but that was an actual thing that you could do to record your voice onto etch it onto a record from home. They were only owned by like recording people, like recording artists, I guess, to make like quick records to send out.
I'm assuming that he had one because maybe Yeah.
He's a conductor. Like, maybe he needed to make a recording. He's obviously never used it before. Just the shots of the instruction manual alone are brilliant.
It's filmed really well.
Yeah. There's a great line in Beetlejuice where they're trying to read the handbook for the recently deceased. And Alec Baldwin says, I can't make a heads or tails of this. This whole book reads like stereo instructions, which doesn't mean a whole lot these days. But this movie perfectly captured what it was like to try to read stereo instructions back then. Just a lot of like wires and diagrams and arrows and
it's
symbols.
Like an IKEA furniture thing.
It is. It is. Except I cannot actually figure it out.
I just kind of BS'd my way through IKEA furniture building. That's what I did with my desk.
I know you're not supposed to use a hammer and nails, but bang, bang, bang.
At the end, I only had one piece that wasn't in my desk. Don't know where it went.
Look at all these pieces I have left.
That desk hasn't collapsed yet, so I'm assuming it wasn't vital.
I forgot about that desk. It's covered in toys and water bottles and a hopping bunny. Mm-hmm. This movie was a bomb.
Yes.
By the way, this movie didn't succeed at all. No one could make heads or tails of it.
Oh, I thought you were using like the modern term for bomb. Like, it was the bomb.
It was not the bomb. It was a bomb.
Well, it was the bomb to us.
Yeah, it really was. Basically, some people consider it the movie that ended Sturgis's career. Basically, we're just like, now you're kind of no longer like a celebrated auteur anymore.
But it was such a good movie.
It was such a good movie, and of course, in these days, it is recognized as a great movie.
Sturgis dead?
Preston Sturgis is long dead.
Okay. I hope that if there is an afterlife, he's looking down and seeing how successful his movie is.
It's much love. There is a Criterion edition that has a beautiful transfer. It has audio commentary. It has an introduction by Terry Jones, which is interesting. Interview with Sturgis's widow. Just, it's now considered like a classic of dark comedy. And I think it's a shame that it wasn't appreciated in its time. I wanted to just talk a little bit about the cast, just so we don't forget about them. His wife, it was played by Linda Darnell. And she was great. Like, the moment when he starts fantasizing about killing her, and each fantasy, she has a different attitude, like, about she just sort of switches on it. Like, the actor herself, like, switches on a dime. Like
her body language, her face, her voice.
Yeah, when he thinks of her as a villain, when he thinks of her as simpering, like, she's so good. Like, I was like, oh my God, I kind of, like, love this character. The character of Barbara, who is married to, I mean, not the character, is that her name? Yeah, Barbara. The character of Barbara, who is married to the brother-in-law.
Her sister.
Yeah, her sister. I thought was just dynamite.
Yes.
She's hilarious. She's upbeat. She plays off of her husband well. And she was played by an actress named Barbara Lawrence, who a lot of people may know from the movie Oklahoma. She had quite a career. She only died in 2013. So she had a long, long life, unlike most of these people we talk about. But I think she was only like 17 years old when she made this movie.
Wow.
Like, she was a young'un.
She did look really young.
She was really young. Oh, we didn't even talk about the tailor and the detective.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about the characters that we actually ship.
The tailor and the detective are neighbors in business. When the conductor guy, I'm just gonna call him that from now on because I can't remember his name ever.
Alfred de Carter, Sir Alfred.
Okay. When Sir Alfred goes to the detective place for the first time to do something.
Harass him.
I guess. He walks up to this man who's just eating his lunch and is just like, I demand to speak to the detective here. And I was like, oh, I don't know anything about that. I'm just the tailor from next door.
I eat my lunch in here.
Yeah.
You the tailor and the detective you find out is a huge fan of Sir Alfred's, which makes the whole interaction even more awkward. He gives two tickets to the detective for reasons. I can't remember why. To the show that night. Because the detective's like, I've never missed a performance of yours except when you were like out of town and I couldn't like afford to go see you. So he gives the detective two tickets. The detective ends up taking the tailor. And they are the original odd couple.
Mm-hmm.
The tailor is supposed to be like uncouth and unprepared.
Which is weird because he's a tailor.
He is weird and he's a tailor.
But like he should know how to wear clothes.
He does not know how to wear clothes. They fall off of him. His collar keeps popping off. That's a classic. I think that's a classic. I don't know what you call it, like the disconnected, like in men's like fancy formal dress, the disconnected, like the unattached collar that you have to like pin down.
It's like in cartoons a lot.
You see
well.
It happen. I was going to say like Tom and Jerry cartoons.
Yeah.
They're constantly like, frrr, shang. I think it's a classic comedy trope.
Yeah.
Like the collar and then like the dickie would like pop up in your face or whatever.
Mm-hmm. You see that a lot in Tom and Jerry. Yeah. Especially when Tom is playing the piano on stage.
Yes.
Jerry's such a.
Jerry was just trying to sleep in that piano. He just wanted to sleep.
Okay, but like also, the cat was just doing his job.
The cat was doing his job. Literally doing his job, which is famous piano player.
Also, like in all the other like episodes, like the cat is also still just doing his job.
What I love about Tom and Jerry is that in most of the episodes, in most of the short films, he is a cat guarding a house. Like he's a cat. That's his job. He's a cat. And that one, he's a famous piano player. But he's still just a cat. You think there'd be a bigger deal about the fact?
I don't know. There were a lot of people there.
There were a lot of people there, but they weren't like, "Oh my god!" Like, there was no sign outside that said, "Like, come see this cat play a piano." Oh my god!
This cat with five fingers and a thumb,
mm-hmm.
or four fingers and a thumb.
It stands like a man, bows like a man, it's tall like a man.
Why was Jerry sleeping in the piano in the first place?
That's where he lives.
No, that's not where he lives.
I have a theory that Jerry is a position. It's a title. It's not and it's not a single mouse. Like a Jerry is
like a Jerry from Rick and Morty.
Oh, I was going to say a Jerry from Jerry Seinfeld, but yes, he's like Jerry from Rick and Morty. So it's Tom who is the cat and Jerry who is whichever mouse he is currently.
Tom is the Rick.
Yes.
Jerry is the mouse.
And Tom is constantly doing battle against any of a number of mice.
Mm-hmm.
And
because mice, you know, they get at it.
Right. But they also don't live that long.
Yeah.
So the Jerrys of the world are the at times just antagonistic for no reason mouse. And Tom, I don't think Tom realizes that it's always a different Jerry, but it doesn't matter because that's why his like anger grows. I still don't know why Tom was a world famous piano player.
What are we talking about?
We're talking about Unfaithfully Yours from 1948. Oh, here's the list. So the overture, the first piece of music that he fantasizes is a piece of music about a femme fatale. And that's what he imagines his wife is, this femme fatale. The second piece of music is about the renunciation of carnal love for a higher and more spiritual goal, which is what he's imagining. Mm-hmm. And the third piece refers to the infernal destiny awaiting an adulterous wife. So that's, there you go. yes, thematically. Movie ruined Preston Sturges' career, ruined his life, but we liked it.
It was great.
We didn't have a problem at all with it. So no. I give it a big thumbs up.
Same.
I will say that
I'll watch this with Lil.
The picture was great. The sound was good. There's something about Preston Sturges that's very modern in his approach to camera work, to character work.
He was ahead of his time.
He really was ahead of his time. I think that...
Had this movie been made today by Preston Sturges, it would have done amazing.
Well, speaking of which, this movie was remade. In 1984.
Wasn't it terrible?
With Dudley Moore, Natasha Kinski, Armand DeSante, and Albert Brooks. It looks like Barry Levinson worked on it, which is funny. And it has roughly the same plot. Dudley Moore plays a conductor whose much younger wife he thinks is cheating on him while he's asked his friend to keep an eye on her, yada, yada, yada. Things get confused. But then the plot seems to like sort of diverge a little bit, but it does have the whole like imagining the murder and then not being able to carry out the murder thing. It was a bomb. It has a 20% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay, but Rotten Tomatoes has like a 21% on like everything.
Yes. Ben, and
because
also
everyone is cynical and awful.
But also, this is a 1984 Dudley Moore movie. Starring Natasha Kinski, which I just, and Armand DeSante. I can't imagine it's worth seeking. What is worth seeking, though, is Unfaithfully Yours from 1948.
It's great.
again, it's available on DVD and Blu-ray. I believe it's available streaming some places, but...
probably on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, definitely, definitely check it out. It is fun and funny and worth your time.
Mm-hmm. You're going to have to send it to me so I can watch it with Lil at some point.
You definitely want to watch it with Lil?
Yeah.
It will be one of our Lil recommends. That's like when the movie is over the top, you know it is a Lil recommend, because it's one you'll take to your good friend.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, like especially nowadays, you really just need some like humor, some good old fashioned dark humor. And I think me and Lil could use that together.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So, Unfaithfully Yours, what does Guillermo del Toro have to say about Unfaithfully Yours?
I don't know, Dad. What does he have to say about it?
So, he did this whole thing with Criterion where he did, like, movie pairings. But his quote about Unfaithfully Yours was, "The candle that burns twice as bright burns half as long, as the saying goes, and Sturges' films and meteoric, puzzling career confirm this. These are masterful films full of mad energy and fireworks." He was pairing it with Sullivan's Travels. Mm-hmm. But Sullivan's Travels also manages to encapsulate one of the most intimate reflections about the role of the filmmaker as the entertainer. Many have attempted to mine the same field as Sturges and all have failed. So he doesn't really say much about Unfaithfully Yours, but he thinks it pairs well with Sullivan's Travels.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'd agree.
I mean, they're both Preston Sturges movies.
They are.
That's probably why they were paired together.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't think if you're going to spend an evening watching two films, they don't seem to like complement each other well.
But they're both very good, and I would definitely watch them one after the other.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I really like.
If we were doing like a themed party and those were the two movies we were watching, then maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
Because like, I don't know. There's some pretty dark comedy in Sullivan's Travels as well.
That's true. That's true.
A guy gets annihilated by a train.
Gets his head run over by a train.
And it's supposed to be funny.
Well, not at that moment. That's what the dramatic part. God agrees. I can see. I mean, obviously, Guillermo del Toro likes Preston Sturges. We've already covered this.
Yes.
Like, he's an auteur. He did daring things. He stood up for the little guy.
It's disgusting in this room right now.
Yeah, it's very sweltering in this room. That's why we're finishing up.
Yes.
Guillermo del Toro really liked this movie. He really likes Preston Sturges. Guillermo del Toro is himself an auteur who does not believe in compromising his vision. And who wasn't always successful in what he tried to do. But he kept doing it anyway.
Yeah. But we enjoyed all of his movies.
Who?
We did. All of Del Toro's movies.
You didn't like one of his movies.
Yeah, but I recommended it in the end.
Yes, you did. You appreciated it for what it was, even if it wasn't your cup of tea.
It was a well-made movie mm-hmm. that didn't suit my personal tastes for obvious reasons.
Yes.
But if you can handle that kind of stuff, I would recommend it.
All right. Well, next time, that's a hearty recommend
that, yeah.
from you. Next episode, next time we are together, we will be finally in the 1950s.
Whoa.
I don't know why I'm doing the opening drums from Money for Nothing. It has nothing to do with the 1950s. But we will also be touching on a Spanish language film from a man who was a Spanish filmmaker who was exiled and forced to continue his career in Mexico. So unlike the opposite of Guillermo del Toro, who was a Mexican filmmaker who was not exile, but he was forced into exile by circumstances and proceeded to make movies in Spain, about Spain. The filmmakers
really did movies too.
The filmmaker's name is Luis Buñuel, who is a famous surrealist. He was good friends with Salvador Dali until they had a huge falling out. He was part of the surreal art scene. He's also extraordinarily political. He was atheist, communist, super controversial in his home country, super controversial in the countries where he lived, super controversial in his adopted country of Mexico. And we are going to watch what is considered one of his masterpieces, Los Olvidados, which I have never seen. But
what does it translate to?
The Olvidados. I don't know. I don't speak Spanish. It was released in America as something else. The Young and the Damned is what it was called in its non-Spanish language release. But this was a movie that was, well, we'll talk about this later, but it was super controversial when it came out. It's not terribly long. So it's got two things going for it that I'm happy with. Made by a controversial guy, not terribly long. But yes, I'm excited. I've never seen a Luis Buñuel movie, and I'm very happy to be watching one. With you.
It's been a train of I'm not very excited movies lately for me.
But what sometimes happens when you're not very excited?
I like.
You end up liking them. So that's why that is our thing here. Always going towards these things with an open mind.
I never go towards them with an open mind.
I always go towards these things with an open mind. And I bring my teenager along. And who am I? I'm Phil.
And I'm Ollie.
And we'll see you next time when.
That's not our outro.
What do we say?
And we'll see you when it's Del Toro time.
And here we go again. I'm Phil.
And I'm Ollie.
And we'll see you when
it's Del Toro time.
Goodbye.
Bye.